previously on WandaVision.
Welcome to the Time Variance Authority. I'm Miss Minutes.
We're gonna need to call some people.
What if?
Welcome back, Swab Kittens. This is I Want My MCU TV with Kelly Gamont.
Howdy do.
Don Melton.
Hello there.
And me, your hostess, Lisa Schmeiser. I am so glad to be back with you. I want to actually give a huge shout out to Don, Kelly, and Nathan for, I think, my favorite episode of the podcast.
Was a lot of fun.
Because it's the one where you did the least amount of work.
See, you're covering for me nicely. This is why I come back week after week. And Swamp Kittens, what I'd like to tell you is you're used to us doing a three-part format for every podcast where we basically recap whatever MCU TV show we've just watched on Disney Plus. And then we react to what we saw in that specific episode. And then finally, we say, really?
Really?
Really? To Don Melton and pelt him with questions about Marvel esoterica. And he always valiantly rises to the challenge. However, we are still a few weeks out from the next Marvel, I almost said Marvel Plus show, it's a Disney Plus show, from the next Disney Plus show, Hawkeye with Hallie Steinfeld and Jeremy Renner. And so, Swamp Kittens, to return to your regularly scheduled podcast feed, we decided instead, what if we went back and took a look at the beginnings of the MCU, where it all started. We thought it'd be fun to review and revisit Iron Man, which was the OG movie, and Thor, which actually introduces Hawkeye's cameo and gives us all an intimation of how big and intricately woven this universe would be. So we gave ourselves the assignment. We had to go watch Iron Man. We had to go watch Thor. And now it's time for us to show you our work. To get started, do we want to start with Iron Man since it's the first, or Thor since it's the one that's got the Hawkeye cameo?
I think let's start with Iron Man. Because it was the real introduction of the MCU. The thing to keep in mind is there had been other Marvel movies, but they weren't Marvel Cinematic Universe. I mean, we had the three Spider-Man movies. We had a Daredevil movie. We had Ang Lee's Hulk. We had X-Men.
So I'm loading my Disney Plus screen now because they refer to these movies hilariously.
They do. It's very
and funny. I want to bring up the precise wording for it. So I'm clicking on Marvel here, and they have the movie sort of sorted out by Marvel Cinematic Universe Phase 1, Marvel Cinematic Universe Phase 2, Marvel in timeline order. Then they have Marvel Legacy. The Marvel Legacy movies include both iterations of the Fantastic Four, all the iterations of X-Men that have Hugh Jackman in them.
Mm-hmm.
And they haven't included Ang Lee's Hulk or the Spider-Man movies yet. It's probably just a matter of time. Anyway,
I'm sure it is, because it's probably a rights issue.
Yeah. Anyway, Marvel Legacy, there you go. And here's my guilty confession. Every time I see the attempted reboot for Fantastic Four, I'm reminded that Miles Teller has the world's most eminently slappable face. Like every time I see him, my palm itches.
Yeah. So, you know, that said, like, we should set the stage a little bit for people who maybe don't remember the world before Marvel owned it.
I think that's great because it's been 14 years nonstop of these movies.
Good Lord. Yes. So, like, we'd had a couple of, like, before Iron Man, we'd had some X-Men movies that were decent, that people enjoyed. We had an attempt at the Fantastic Four, and of all the Marvel movies, that's certainly one.
That is a movie with Marvel characters.
That is certainly, if you want to, you can watch it. Some may interpret.
And if you have to, you can watch the second one.
If you don't have any friends and you don't want to have any friends, you can invite people over for a movie marathon.
If you have friends and wish to solve that problem.
Actually, so here are the things I will say about the early Fantastic Four movies before I valiantly attempt to yank us back on track with some context. And what I will say is you have a very young, very callow Chris Evans as Johnny Storm. And even then, he's got the kind of screen presence that pops off the screen. And I will also say he had great chemistry with Michael Chiklis. And I enjoyed watching him and Michael Chiklis together. And I remember enjoying them and then having to apologize to my husband for having making him watch them, the first movie with
But also, like, that's a thing that, you know, sort of worked against Marvel, because they went, yeah, and you know who's playing Captain America? And everybody went,
Johnny Storm.
Got the guy from the D-bag from Fantastic Four to play Captain America.
But then they got another D-bag from Fantastic Four to play Killmonger a decade later. So it all worked out.
I mean, sure. But like, it's just a thing to consider, you know, like as we look at the world now, which is a very different world than the one that Iron Man came into, you know, right. And that's before you even get to the production itself or Marvel swaggering around Hollywood going, yeah, we're going to tell this massive story across a bunch of films.
Yeah, there weren't a bunch of films. That's the thing to keep in mind.
So cast your mind back to 2008. Lindsay Lohan and Paris Hilton are still straddling the earth like a pair of colossi.
iPhone 3G was the cutting edge of technology.
Lisa, the visual for that was just so bad.
Robert Downey Jr., you have to understand that in 2008, Robert Downey Jr. was just beginning to affect a bit of a turnaround, because he had a fairly serious bout with addiction and a high profile relapse in the early 2000s. Yes. And it wasn't until about 2005 with the movie Kiss Kiss Bang Bang that he got thrown a lifeline, thanks to director Shane Black. Kiss Kiss Bang 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 with Val Kilmer, Robert Downey Jr., a great snappy film. People were reminded that they liked Robert Downey Jr. for more than tabloid fodder. He then slides into Good Night and Good Luck in a great supporting role. And then slides into Zodiac, again, playing off Mark Ruffalo as two San Franciscans who were caught up in the Zodiac killer case in the 1970s. And insurance companies were just beginning to say, okay, maybe we won't lose money on this guy if we have him in a movie.
Correct.
And then in 2008, he makes Tropic Thunder, which is truly a relic of its time.
Goodness sakes, yes.
And he makes Iron Man. And what you have to also understand about the comics landscape in 2008 is Ultimates was still semi-dominating the ethos at that point. At that point, you had Ultimate Spider-Man, Ultimate X-Men, you had Ultimate Daredevil at some point.
All of the Ultimate things, yeah.
But the art in Ultimates had really shaken up the aesthetic of what the Avengers were supposed to look like. And you had an Iron Man who looked less like the bastard cousin of J. Jonah Jameson and more like a dude who knew what the word manscaping was, right?
Yeah.
So and best of all, like in Marvel Ultimates, they turn Nick Fury into a black guy who's explicitly modeled on Samuel L. Jackson, which, because I can remember picking up the comics and being like, oh my gosh, that's Samuel L. Jackson.
They put Samuel L. Jackson in a comic book. This is right. Amazing.
Yeah. So it's 2008. People are still hung up on like HBO's anti-heroes, and there's just a boatload of movies are dead. Prestige television is where it's at. We all love our TiVos, blah, blah, blah. Iron Man. And everyone's like, oh, the guy from Swingers is directing a superhero movie. Durf, 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 durf.
Unquote. Yeah.
The other thing to keep in mind is, like I said, the previous Marvel movies that came, there was no such thing as the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Right.
Or phase one, phase two, or phase three.
No.
This is they made up after 2008. The other thing to keep in mind is the production of Iron Man and The Incredible Hulk, which followed like less than a month and a half later. Kevin Feige was involved, but he was like the second or third string producer here. Mm-hmm. He wasn't the boss of everything.
Right.
You know, it wasn't until we get to Iron Man 2 or Thor or whatever that he's running the whole production. And that's when, you know, the term Marvel Cinematic Universe started to get coined. But the thing to keep in mind is, even though they didn't have that whole thing, you can see the plan laid down here. And one thing I think that hit me as I watched both movies, that you know that there's a plan, and it's mm-hmm. one guy, and it's not our favorite bald African-American guy.
No,
it is Clark Gregg.
Coulson is so good in both of these movies. You
love Isn't him he so excellent? Yes. And he's a thread that yeah. weaves everything together here. Mm-hmm. And he's like the payoff in the Avengers.
Yeah. Yeah. This is why Killing Me in the Avengers is so great. Spoilers yes. for a movie that's a decade old at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Nick Fury, obviously a threat, but Agent Coulson, big deal.
So what was interesting is I watched Iron Man again with our daughter, who of course was still a theoretical notion when the first one was made and came out, and we had to, and she's like, wow, I really don't like Tony Stark. Like, the whole time we're watching, she's all, I really don't like him. And I thought, and I was like, wait and see. But, and then we had to educate her on, honey, you have to remember that before this, there weren't stingers in credits most of the time. Like, the fact that we have the Nick Fury thing was like a big deal. Like, there were weblogs about it. There were like news stories telling people to stay at the credits. And mm-hmm. now if movies don't have stingers, you're like, what? I've been cheated.
Exactly.
But yeah, what I noticed yeah,
this
about-
made the front page of USA Today with that in there.
But yeah. what I notice about it is yeah, Tony is really unlikable in this movie, like all the way yeah. through. And I don't know. It would be fun to ask our swamp kittens when they noticed how it changed. But like, you can argue that the evolution of Tony Stark as a character is the overarching story of Marvel Phase 1 through Phase 4, because by the end of it, he's a self-sacrificing hero and a husband and a father and blip, blip, blip. But in this one, he's kind of the type of person who would inspire his employees to go on strike and blow up like a giant rat and picket yeah. things.
Like, if he had died at the, if that iteration of Tony Stark had died at the end of this movie, I wouldn't have cared. It would have been yeah. fine. I would have been like,
Coulson could have asked out Pepper. It could have been a whole different what if.
yeah. Like when I was rewatching it, that was the thing that I was noticing, was like, yeah, you know, if this had gone the other way for Tony at the end of this, I'm not sure that would have been the worst thing. You know, in 2008, I'd have been like, huh, that's an interesting Marvel decision to kill off Iron Man.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the thing is the casting in this movie is so good. And I don't think it's, oh, we had a 20-year plan for the casting, because no, they didn't. They got who's available.
No.
But they did a great job in casting Tony Stark. They cast an actor as Tony Stark, who also grew up in a public eye with a famous dad and mm-hmm. has had his own share of problems, and yet has an enormously sympathetic and human core to him, which is why, despite the fact that he's just an unrepentant, privileged jackball with a superiority complex, you're like, you're like, well, it would, I guess I would weep for humanity if you died in a cave. But what I like about this movie is how often everyone is calling Tony on his nonsense, like, and not in that quippy late stage MCU way where I was like, oh, you're such a turkey. Now let's go use some CGI to blow up the bad guys. But rather, like, when Tony's in the cave, Yinsen is like, you don't remember meeting me because you're a drunken, self-involved boor, and I keep you alive only because it serves my purposes. And don't you waste my life and your life for this. And then yeah. Pepper's like, you know, you can put the moves on me, but you have to understand this is super, super inconvenient for me. And I kind of hate the situation you put me in. And I like you despite myself. Mm-hmm. And like, Coulson has no time for Tony whatsoever. And I'm vaguely sympathetic to Obadiah Stane, who has had to put up with his jackball antics for 2 decades.
Yeah.
But at the end of it, you've got somebody who's like, okay, I have just cobbled together a super suit. I've had my worldview rocked, and now I want to do something because I have the means to. It's a really interesting movie about exercising privilege.
Yeah. You know, you were talking about the casting, Lisa. The key thing Marvel did, and you have to do this with every superhero mm-hmm. movie, these costume antics, you don't cast for the costume, you cast for the person inside the costume.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, picking Robert Downey Jr. as Iron Man, Chris Evans as Captain America, these kinds of things, they're just like they're perfect casting. I thought there was some really surprising casting in this when I first heard about it. Jeff Bridges, mm-hmm. is one of my favorite all-time actors. I mean, he's the dude.
He's the dude.
And as Obadiah Stane. And
his
just,
eyes are so cold. It's amazing.
Oh,
yes,
man.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. It calls back to what's the film? Jagged Edge.
Yeah.
Where, he basically plays just this total evil character. But he's so good on this. And the commitment to shave his head for it.
I know.
Just priceless.
Yeah.
That's just he's crazy, man. And so I thought that was very, very good. The other thing is there are very few people, and your daughter was right, not to like Tony Stark.
Yeah.
Because he is not really likable, but there's this sliver. I mean, he's a likable asshole. Right. Yeah. And there are very few people who can play that, the likable asshole, I've heard it called. Mm-hmm. And that sliver of integrity, that sliver of,
he's got a lot of charisma, charm, whatever you want to call it. Like, there's an awful lot of that happening in the first place.
But he's actually, in the end, although he talks a good game about doing it for himself and stuff, he's actually trying to do the right thing in the movie. And we watch him go down and struggle with that, but also, indulge himself.
So we did this inadvertently, but let's pretend we didn't and point out that both of the movies that we're discussing, Iron Man and Thor, have at their heart an immensely privileged protagonist who discovers what happens when they don't have their privilege to fall back on.
Yes.
And the whole point to both of their character arcs is when they are faced with the howling void where their character should be, they have something in their personality and their makeup that says, this is unacceptable. I know I can be better than this. And then they commit to doing it.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it says anything significant about the MCU that these are the first two movies that began to build the franchise. I'm sure somebody who is a deeper thinker than I am could connect it to like the greater moment in the United States when you did have people like, remember it was a presidential election year. There was a lot of talk about what it meant to be an American and what it meant to be involved in your country. And Thor didn't come out in 2008, I hasten to add. But I do think that one of the things the Marvel movies have done is sort of anticipated and reflected some of the cultural conversations in the country. And I just want to call out for a moment the fact that the conversations that Thor and Tony Stark have with themselves and everybody else in the movies are very, very similar when you look at it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
They are interesting parallels when you sit down and sort of watch them together, so to speak. And that's part of what was sort of entertaining about watching them. And, honestly, like I had a vague recollection of Tony Stark in the original Iron Man movie when I sat down to watch it. And one thing that I realized from that was my recollection was only a little bit inaccurate. I was sort of worried, honestly, about watching this because I was like, this movie is probably not aging very well. And it actually did better because I had kind of forgotten about all the people that went, Tony, that's nonsense, and, weren't having it. And so it was kind of, it was almost a relief to watch all of these conversations, sort of different facets of the same conversation, which was like, Tony, this aggression will not stand, basically. And
we also just rewatched The Big Lebowski really recently too. So there was actually a point during Iron Man where, you see Pepper Potts very smoothly handling the journalist whose name I'm blanking on out the door. And
taking out the trash. Yes.
Yeah. And I said, he's treating objects as women, man. it's such great casting though. Don, you were talking about that and it's just rock solid all the way down.
Well, I think not only in this film, but the next film, Thor, I had actually seen Iron Man, the 2008 film, all the way through fairly recently, sometime within the last 18 months, I'd watched it. But I realized as I'm watching Thor, what in the sheol is the matter with me that I haven't watched this film all the way through? And I had actually forgotten entire subplots or reasons for things. And I was like, what a jerk I am. And we went 9 episodes of Loki, right? And I hadn't gone back to the source. And I was riveted. Iron Man is a marvelous film that started the ball rolling. It's one of my sister's favorite films of all time. She just loves it. But Thor surprised me by how well it held up. And one thing that surprised me watching both of these films again is I thought back to the little kid in me. And this happened too when I'm sure with Captain America, the First Avenger, is how much this harkened back to me reading the original comics. And how much, like in Iron Man, I'm in the theater and I am just about to nerd out when Downey presses his hands on the sheets of the design and we see the original Iron Man costume. And if you're a comic book nerd, you know exactly what that looks like. Because that's the way
you when I saw that scene, Don.
Yeah,
me too.
That's the way that's the way it was drawn in a sense. You know, it was a gray suit, low tech, everything else. And the scenes that harken back for me with Thor was very different from the origin in the comics. And I don't know if everybody got the Dr. Donald Blake jokes. All the nerds were laughing their asses off. All of us laughing our asses off. It was very different, but it was the sort of tactile feel of the bigger than life and almost pretentiousness of Asgard and the Nine Realms and everything else like that. The sort of emphasized Kirby-esque portrayal of it. I mean, I was looking at the cityscape of Asgard and thinking, oh my God, that's straight out of like a Jack Kirby sketchbook.
It had a real sci-fi paperback novel from the 1970s feel to it. And I found that tremendously appealing.
Yes, yes.
I'm sure we all had the experience of either going to the library or your local spinner rack, and there would always be a book where, bafflingly, there were people in loincloths with laser swords, and there were dragons and spaceships on the cover of it, and you're like, of course, this all works together.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah, and Asgard had that aesthetic going for it, too, I think.
So, and I must say, Chris Hemsworth, well, with Thor, you got to cast for the guy in the costume because that's who Thor is. I mean, that's a different thing. And they were lucky to find him. Who are the most known people in that cast? Probably Natalie Portman and Stellan Skarsgård, right?
Anthony Hopkins. Don't sleep on Anthony Hopkins.
Oh, Anthony Hopkins. Yes, yes. How could I forget that? So perfect casting there. But, you know, your leads and everything else, Tom Hiddleston.
Yeah.
Who the heck is he?
There's a hilarious article that people like to surface every once in a while. New York Magazine's entertainment vertical, vulture.com, wrote a snide little piece about, oh, the Thor franchise is going to sink because they hired these two complete unknowns, Chris Hemsworth and Tom Hiddleston, to play Thor and Loki.
Yeah.
Good luck, guy. It's basically like a snotty little piece of, again, 2008 level blogging. And it resurfaces from time to time when people want to point out like how wrong those reads were. That said, I watched Thor like after watching Iron Man, you know, going big, doing the homework. And I should preface this by saying that last Saturday, we finally had my kiddo's birthday party. It was rain delayed. And we co-host it every year. This is important only because I need you to know that we had to select the movie by committee. Both of the birthday girls had to agree. And the movie they agreed on was Thor Ragnarok. And they chose to screen this movie to an audience where fully half of the children were not into Marvel movies or having seen them at all.
It matters not. It's brightly colored. It's hilarious. It's a buddy movie.
And so as I was serving up ice cream sundaes in lieu of cake and fielding questions from 11-year-old girls, what is this about? I finally settled by saying, it's a road trip comedy with a beautiful blonde idiot and his angry best friend. And we sat down, we put out the outdoor screen because, you know, we live in a pandemic, the kids had a distance. And parents began trickling in to pick up the kids when we were about 2/3 of the way through the movie. And what ended up happening instead was us putting out like another extra 10 chairs so that parents could sit and finish
watching the movie.
And all of the kids were like, this is the greatest thing ever. And it was fun to watch. And you go from that. And when I was watching the first Thor movie, I thought to myself, it's amazing we got to Thor 3, because Thor 3 is to Thor like what a 7, I was going to say like what a 737 is to a paper airplane in some respects. Like, it's hard to believe they're part of the same arc. And when I was watching Kenneth Branagh's take, which in keeping with the director being Branagh, has a lot of real Shakespearean beats and some really classical references and things like that. And I was like, I think he handled the material really well at the time with there being no roadmap. That said, I really wish they had leaned hard into Chris Hemsworth's comedic chops early on, because there are some parts of this movie that I found a little embarrassing to watch with the lines they give him and the way he has to deliver them and give them this gravitas. And that's just not, it's just not a good fit.
Oh, wow. I did not take it that way at all. Like the opposite of that way. And that's what I was getting at, was the pretentiousness of the material. I mean, if you read the comics back in the 60s, Brenna, he riffed on Shakespeare really, really well. And he pulled out just enough of the silliness of that. But he had people like Hopkins, serious people like Skarsgård as well in there to anchor it. And he also let Chris Hemsworth stretch his legs. The subdual scene of Hemsworth in the medical examination room is just hysterical when his face goes down the glass. That when he gets backed into by the car and the expression on his face when he said,
it's so good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just those beats. This is the start of the MCU. This is the start of all these characters. And I'm sure the producers were walking around in some ways with just clenched sphincters, worried about how this stuff was going to be taken. And in some ways, when Thor premiered, it was beaten up by the critics for some of this stuff. But me, as a nerd and as a fan, I thought it was an almost perfect take. When it came out, I liked it better than the Hulk film that had just come out. I think it was like 1 year prior, it's like 15 months prior. And I was just a total Hulk nerd when I was a kid, too. And I actually liked Thor better. But when we get to Joss Whedon's Avengers movie 2 years later, Thor still has that vibe. It's still that larger-than-life pretentiousness.
What ho! It is my burden of glorious purpose. Yeah, that whole
thing. Somebody had put together, what do you call it? Like texts, and it was like superhero texts.
Yeah.
And it was like they got Thor an iPhone, and like every time he talks, like he texts everyone in all caps, first of all. And second of all, like he always calls Tony Man of Iron, which I, and like it, they're so funny.
There used to be a Tumblr called Text from the Avenger of it. Oh no, it was Text, the superhero text. It's like a Tumblr and a blog.
It was so funny. And Man of Iron, I have discovered, like, you know, and it was like, I discovered people use punctuation to make facial expressions, and this is the greatest thing. Behold.
So I might have imagined this in the Thor movie. And I said, no, and because, Don, are you familiar with the movie The Lion in Winter?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Kelly, have you seen it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, it's my favorite
live production of it too. Like, yeah.
So it's my favorite holiday movie. And and one of my favorite scenes in that movie is when there's this big confrontation. Henry is, as usual, yelling, and young Anthony Hopkins, who's playing Richard, pushes back against him. He says, "You've never called. I would have come if you had called just once." And there's like this 3 decades of pain and betrayal and rejection, and realizing that his dad has had him on a string and has been abusing his goodwill the whole time. And so when I was watching Thor again, and there's the scene where Loki discovers that, you know, he was yeeted from the Ice Kingdom, and it wasn't merely because Odin has a soft spot for abandoned babies, but rather that Odin's like, "I like babies and you could be useful." And I swear that Branagh framed and set up the entire scene as a mirror of that Lion in Winter scene from
the I have no doubt that he did that, because that's just the kind of film nerd, and
that's exactly the kind of quote he'd make. Yeah,
that's exactly. And I'm sure Anthony Hopkins knew that too.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
And you know, it's with Thor, I remember watching at the time and being like, "Oh wow, they've taken a character that I don't give a hoot about." Although I like his iteration, the Ultimates, and we can zip onto that in a minute. It's like, "Oh, they took a character where I was all meh about him, and I like this world that they've built, and I like Jane and Darcy's repartee, and the fact that they have they are more than arm candy for the movie, but are in fact the engine that teaches Thor morality and gives him table stakes." And I was watching him again this time, and I found myself like, I want to watch that episode of Thor and What If again, because I want to see more of Jane and Darcy. Like, Jane and Darcy together is a good time.
Yes.
Yeah. Now there's a road trip, a buddy picture that you want, right?
Part of watching it, like, I sort of felt bad for Natalie Portman because of, you know, the next movie. But I didn't really remember how directly she had contributed to everything. Like, I knew she was, you know, kind of there, but it didn't always feel like, like, in my recollection anyway, it didn't feel like she had had sort of as much to do with what was happening, because I was sort of thinking of it as like the Asgard movie with a side trip to Earth. And it's really not.
It's the Earth movie with a couple detours in Asgard.
The Earth movie with a couple nice shots of Idris Elba, speaking of more amazing casting.
But he's so stiff in this movie. I appreciate like the sly humor he brings to the table when he's all, "Okay, fine, Warriors 3. You go do your thing on Earth and I'll let you get off on a technicality."
Which is a great moment, you know, when he goes, "You're going to commit treason." And they're all like, "Yeah." And he's like, "Okay, cool."
He's all, "Well, I suppose I could stop you, but I could also go on break."
I'm going on a coffee break right now. And you know, I just happened to leave the key in the lock. If somebody were to turn it, oh, I don't know.
Well, one of my complaints about the Marvel is they really didn't use Idris Elba to his best. Like, they tried to make up for it a bit in Thor Ragnarok. But
yes, I agree.
I will admit that when I saw this movie in the beginning, I was like, "You're kind of squandering this super charismatic, super subtle actor by sticking him in armor and like giving him 2 scenes." So that
and
was
then
like
we freeze him solid for the entire third reel.
Yeah, and so that was like a little bit of a nitpick. But I would also like to discuss Loki in this film, because just like Tony Stark is a real jackball. from like beginning of the movie to the end, like, he's a jackball with a conscience by the end of it, but like let's not confuse him with being a good guy just yet. What I thought was super interesting about this film is, although you can see where Loki's heart is broken by his dad and he's had envy issues, like, Loki's Loki's a real jackball. He's not like the chic metrosexual, "Oh, I quip and say things" of later movies. And he's worlds away from the character that we had in the Loki series. Like, he's just nasty in this film. Like, he is he is a snake.
All the way to the ground.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
No, they're... I saw this again, and mm-hmm. I had that impression, you know, from the comics. He definitely is a snake.
Yeah, he's a real turkey in the comics.
So mm-hmm. I had that impression when I watched the movie the first time. But in retrospect, knowing all the movies and stuff, I see where they were laying the groundwork and the angst and the betrayal. He desperately, desperately wanted the approval of his father, Odin. And it was clear that he never thought of himself as Laufey's son. He hated Laufey for abandoning him, essentially. And there was glee in him killing his biological father. But there was just torment and angst. I thought Hiddleston's portrayal there to make him this sympathetic villain was so cool, even in the Avengers, where he truly does some mean horrible things. You know, eyeball anyone.
He's just such a meanie.
but there's something in there, you know, like when he says, I think I'll take that drink now, mm-hmm. at the end.
Well, he's got that well-bred savoir-faire.
Yes. Gosh darn that Hiddleston, he can just play that thing with every line he can. I just thought that he and Hemsworth, especially, you know, milked everything they had just to perfection. And then he had like crazy people like Stellan Skarsgård. His take, you know, that character, which sort of existed in the comics, sort of, mm-hmm. But was really created for him, I thought was just awesome. And Natalie Portman, well, one thing, they wrote her great. Yeah. You know, they just gave her great lines and a great character and so much more character than was in the comics, especially the original comics. Pepper Potts, and Jane Foster, and you know, all the girlfriends, wives, whatever, you know, they were all interchangeable almost. It wasn't until we got to, you know, the Wasp that there was any kind of difference there. So I thought what she did, that was just so cool. I also thought the introduction of Jeremy Renner, that mm-hmm. really surprised me in the theater. I did not know he was playing Hawkeye, and I thought, how the heck did they get Jeremy Renner in this film for like Oscar 5 minutes?
What is he doing here? Yeah.
Yeah. And so it didn't even occur to me. This is how dense I am. Oh, they're assembling the Avengers.
Yeah.
You know, because Captain America hadn't been out yet.
Yeah.
They're assembling the Avengers. He's going to be Hawkeye, right? It was a great introduction, though.
And you have to understand that at the time that Thor came out, the reason Renner came out as such a surprise is he had just produced 2 Oscar-nominated performances back-to-back with The Hurt Locker and then The Town. And this was another indication that you're like, oh, wow, this film company is actually... They keep casting people who get awards, nominations for what they do. They're not just going with people who look good in a suit, or they're not just... Wow. And these actors are taking these jobs. It was kind of a big deal at the time. And at this point now, whenever they cast a Marvel movie, you're like, okay, who are they going to get? Because at this point they can have their pick.
Cause I mean, we've seen like, even, you know, like as they were slowly building any sort of universe, you know, like we're watching these go by and like, you know, we get Jeff Bridges, who's pretty well known.
Terrence Howard, who was also an Academy nominee.
They get him, and they get like Robert Downey Jr. That at that point, like, people are starting to be well reminded, as we talked about, that he's a good actor. So we get them for this first movie. We get Anthony Hopkins in mm-hmm. Thor. We get, you know, like all these great, and then like, but that streak just sort of continues. And now, like, you know, like, we'll go watch other movies because, like, well, did you know Loki was in this movie about a creepy ass haunted house? Ooh, let's go watch that, you know, because it's got Loki in it. Like, it's funny how it's turned into a different sort of thing now, you know, because, like, you know, there was certainly a stretch when you sort of had people, you know, resorting to making just a superhero movie, and that's totally not the case anymore.
No, it certainly kicked Chris Hemsworth and Tom Hiddleston's career stellar heights and gave them, you know, they not only got to mimeograph their money, they got really interesting roles. And things that they could sink their teeth into. So they weren't typecast at all. Same thing with the rest of the Avengers. You know, they got to do lots and lots of interesting things. One thing I'll say that was probably different about these two films is how they came together. I did not know this at the time, but Iron Man didn't really have a script in the same sense that most movies have a script. You know, it was not set in stone. There is an enormous amount of credit that goes to John Favreau for directing this, because he was really, in a way, winging it. Not in a panic, but, you know, he was just doing it from his gut and sort of making it up as he was going along. And it says a lot for Avi Arad and Kevin Feige that they let him do that, because it actually disturbed Jeff Bridges.
I can imagine
when he got to the set, you know, the sort of improvisational nature of it. That was certainly not the case with Kenneth Branagh. And I know that John Favreau brought in some actors and other people that he'd worked with before, people in the background that are kind of surprising, like, you know, Tom Morello of Rage Against the Machine. You know, he's one of the terrorists in the film. You know, Breno had actually just previously worked with Tom Hiddleston, which is how he got the job as Loki.
It's worth noting too that Hiddleston is Etonian and extremely posh and very well connected to the British theater community. I think he would have been fine even if he had never been Loki.
Oh, sure. Yeah. We would have all missed out on that.
Yeah. He initially auditioned for Thor.
Yeah.
So if that had been the case, I don't think we would have had a Thor Ragnarok like we understand it, just because the very nature of who Thor was would be different. Don, you mentioned that little moment of upper class sangfroid when Loki was like, I think I'll take that drink now. And that's like bred to the bone posh. You would have had a Thor who carried himself as somebody who was bred for the job and knows it. And is effectively your Prince William, you know, somebody who's like, I've never had a choice about this. This is simply what I was raised to do. Yeah. That's a very different character than the Thor we have with Hemsworth. And I'm grateful for that.
Oh yeah.
Because I love the loopy and slightly freewheeling energy where he's just like, I'm a responsible dude and I do things because I've been raised to take my responsibilities seriously. But I also enjoy hopping into tiny spaceships with raccoons and jaunting off for parts unknown. So, yeah.
Well, the funny thing is, one of the first people to agree with you on the perfect casting of Chris Hemsworth as Thor would be Tom Hiddleston.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When they met and they started to work together, he was like, oh God, this is just, Hiddleston was so excited, especially I was listening to an interview with him, the first time he got to put on the Loki helmet.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He was just, wow, you know, just almost vibrating with excitement to be in the movie. And to be able to act with Tony Hopkins. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sir Anthony Hopkins. Wow. that was also a bit of a poop running down the leg moment for Hemsworth too, you know, because this guy, you know, he's not part of the English theater scene. He's just some crazy Australian, right?
No, he was an Australian who won the Dancing with the Stars show. And I believe And he did a soap in Australia because it's apparently a requirement for citizenship down there.
Yes, and, that's true. Yeah.
You have to be on Neighbors before they let you leave the continent, I think.
Yes. It's a passport requirement.
Yes. Yeah. This is where like we find out that we have some very angry Antipodean swamp kittens.
Three pieces of mail and how long were you on Neighbors? And yeah.
They're like, it's swamp crocodiles down here. Thank you.
Don't the horns go the opposite direction in the southern hemisphere?
We recently splashed out and bought the Hollow Crown series off of the iTunes store, and watching Hiddleston as Prince Hal, where he's basically having the Thor experience, you know, learning how to shake off his callow mentality and his pleasures and rise to the challenges of kingship. Watching how he plays that versus how he plays Loki, it really is two extremely different performances from the same person. And
yes,
just from the way he holds himself to everything else like that. Whereas with Chris Hemsworth, you're like, oh, it's Chris Hemsworth. Now he's a sea captain. Oh, it's Chris Hemsworth. Now he's a race car driver. Sooner or later, he's going to make the comedy about babysitting. It's coming. But he's so...
Yeah, I'm going to think about that now, like forever. But like one of the other things that was funny about that was I definitely felt that what if energy... when he was walking up to the throne, like, that's right. You know, at the very beginning of Thor, like that was very much the one we got that, you know, that shows up on Earth and is like, have you tried this? It always refills. It's fantastic. Yeah. Very much that one.
Well, yeah, there was a certain Marvel princessness. I read a Disney princessness to
yes.
it. Right.
Yes.
Yes. And then. He gets called princess in the movie and loses his mind. And I admit I had to pause and laugh at that heartily. Cause I just knew how unhappy that particular iteration of Thor would be with us talking about him the way that we do.
Yes.
Well, what's also really interesting about these two early films, there are some real aesthetic differences. And again, you cast your mind back, and there are so many more practical effects in Iron Man. A lot of the fights look a lot more tactile. It looks like there's a lot more at stake. It's not CGI
especially in the first half scenes.
Yeah.
The first half of the film, it's a lot more practical effects, and I really like that. And I think one person we have to thank for that is Jon Favreau, because he loves having actors. He hates having actors against a green screen.
Yeah.
He'll put actors against a screen, but he'll project something on it for them on occasion. But getting performances out of that, and that really makes a difference for an actor like Robert Downey Jr. This guy is an acting nerd. And so when he lands in the desert and he casts off the detritus of the first Iron Man suit, it's just so gritty and real and everything else like that. And I think the production values and production design, so gritty and real. Now, that's not done at all really in Thor. In Thor, Branagh was going for the heightened Kirby-esque look to everything. Mm-hmm. Even on some of the Earth scene, he was doing that.
However, if you take a look at Hemsworth himself, he's still built like a human being, and that's his real hair. I think aesthetically, those movies are a little bit more grounded than what we get now, where everybody is sculpted and buffed and processed to a point where they do have this superhero sheen to them, but there's a real appeal in the early films where, like, Robert Downey Jr. looks good for a dude in his 40s, but you can't grate cheese on his abs, and that's great. Like, I like that. And yeah. Then with Chris Hemsworth, he's fit, but he's fit like, oh, this is a guy who surfs for 4 hours a day, and not, oh, this is a guy who hasn't eaten a carb since 2009 and has to eat like a whole chicken every 4 hours to maintain muscle mass. Like, yes. there's a little bit less of a hyper fantastical element to the actors at this point. Like, again, their own hair, their own bodies, they haven't been put through like the Marvel machinery with the weird trapezius.
There wasn't much Marvel machinery at that point.
Yeah. And I found that tremendously appealing for origin stories too, because yes. It makes them more human, and it's scaled a little bit differently. Like, there's something very, even with the fantastical Kirby-esque imagery, that the 1970s sci-fi cover aesthetic of the Thor movie, there's something very human and intimate about the scale. And the same goes for the Iron Man movies, where it feels tactile and human in a way that a lot of the newer movies don't. The newer movies are these huge sweeping epics, and you're almost conscious of the millions of dollars of resources that churn them out. These two don't have that, and I found that really appealing.
Yeah.
And it could be like my tiresome Gen X blatting with, I knew them before they were cool, and zines, indie, because like Gen X. But but I did really like how both Hemsworth and Downey Jr. here looked like people who had been confronted with something and then became heroes by virtue of something in their character, and not people who were biologically engineered to be better than the rest of us.
Yeah.
Right. Gotcha. Yeah. And that's very true. And that's why it's fun to go back and look at these first films. What I'm struck by is, one, how well they hold up. For example, you know, that's one case. But two, how well they just dovetail into the direction that Marvel wanted to take everything. I mean, everything makes sense. They were dropping all the notes. That's why I, you know, opened up talking about the key character in both films being Coulson, played by Clark Gregg. It's a lot of thinking ahead and crossing your fingers too to do that. And it's a lot of trusting in lots of people working together to pull this stuff off. You know, Marvel hasn't hit one out of the park every time, but they've got a pretty good track record with these things.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I'm sure that there'll be gaps between TV shows. Again, there are two things I'm curious about. And one is what movies we think we want to tackle next after this. To see if we can draw the line from the earliest days of the MCU to what's going on the TV shows now. And two, what the first movie we hit that will be like, ugh. Like,
right.
We're like, we like that at the time. Why? You know, what that will be and how our affections have shifted for it. that'll be a thing. I was honestly surprised by how much fondness I felt for both of these movies. Even as I was busy, like, adding context to the small people I sat next to, or
yeah,
noting how aesthetically different they hit at the time. Mm-hmm. Iron Man is still, like, if they had never made another Marvel movie after that, that still would have been a really fun and interesting thing to watch, where if it was on Stars, you'd be like, oh, I liked this, and you'd sit down and watch it for a while. Mm-hmm. And that's a success. I would argue that makes it a big success as a movie, because a movie that you want to watch again is doing its job, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Or even, you know, have on, even, you know, like, there are some movies that if it's on, it doesn't matter when I came into it, I will watch to the end, whatever it is. Like, it'll be on. Maybe I'm doing something else, but I will continue from wherever I came in all the way to the credits. And this Thor is definitely one of those.
Right. And for me, being a nerd, I love these movies because this is, you know, this is doing what my sister and I dreamed about when we were kids in the 60s. Wouldn't it be great if they, and we always, you know, cast these movies with the actors that we knew at the time.
Sure.
But these two movies I like just because they're good movies, right? They're good stories. You know, the hero goes on a journey, and it's an interesting journey. And I like the fact that there are worlds that are imagined that they fill out. It also doesn't feel rushed for being a 2-hour movie. You know, I got the story. I didn't feel like they had to hold my hand on the mythos if I didn't know anything about it. And I also think they didn't beat any dead horses with some of this stuff. They also, in just the right way, didn't take themselves seriously at the right time. You know, some of this stuff is a little silly when you think about it. And I like the fact that it had the right vibe at, you know, those times. So, because when you do fantastical things like that, you know, this is one way, for example, we were talking and trashing the Fantastic Four films. This is one way the Fantastic Four films fail. They do seem hokey.
Yeah.
Right. These don't.
Let's what if this for just a moment and then wrap up what has been a fantastic conversation. What if the Fantastic Four actually got a writer and a director who decided to make a movie about a dysfunctional family learning how to work together, which is what the Fantastic Four has always been, as opposed to an origin story about four boring but hot professionals who have a space accident.
Yeah. I never thought about it like that.
Which was unfortunately the movie we got.
Jason Snell says really useful and insightful things all the time, but one that has stuck with me and been the prism through which I view the MCU films is, with every MCU film, it's genre film plus formula. And one of the things we haven't seen the MCU do yet is tackle a family drama. And maybe that's what The Eternals is. We'll find out tomorrow. But there's a really great Fantastic Four alternate comics book. We actually did an incomparable episode on it. So I'm Googling now while I talk. And the premise was they don't go to space. It's just a comic book about four people who do have these relationships where Johnny is Sue's brother and Ben is somebody who's Reed Richards' best friend out of habit rather than affinity. And Reed is this remote dude who talks down to Sue, who feels invisible in her marriage and her life. And what if you made that movie? And you'd have to throw in the powers, of course, but what if you actually spent time excavating the relationships and were like, okay, these people have things to work out with each other before they can even become a team. They're the exact opposite of the Avengers, who like are not interested in working anything out with each other ever, but they become a team all the time anyway. I want to see that movie. I want to see that Fantastic Four movie.
It'd be interesting.
And that really describes, you know, the early, I remember, and I was a kid. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was really a kid, you know, in 1961, when I'm like 5 years old. Mm-hmm. So I read these when I was about 8. I went back and read my sister's collection. And it struck me that, good grief, these people are as whiny as our family, and our extended family, and as screwed up. And the whole superhero part of it was, I think Marvel did it the right way. It was like, that was the B story. The A story was the relationships, right? Mm-hmm. And if they can get back to that, that would be awesome. And that would fit into, you know, Jason's description of how the formula should work, right?
Yeah.
I still think they need to do a Western, though. Marvel needs to do a Western.
Oh, they absolutely do. And it needs to be a space Western. Okay, so the comic book I was referring to was called Unstable Molecules, and it's written by James Sturm, S-T-U-R-M, and it came out in 2003. And I believe we discussed, I'm looking at this now, we discussed this back in 2010. Yes. It was Incomparable episode number 10, Unstable Molecules. It came out on Halloween in 2010. So 12 years ago, we discussed a Fantastic Four comic I can't stop thinking about and would dearly love to see being made into the MCU. But you know what? That's MCU phase 5 or 6. We were back at phase 1. Were we glad we went back to check out the two early movies?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean,
nobody's childhoods got ruined.
No, mine was enhanced by the experience.
Yeah.
And I just want to thank whichever one of you suggested doing this, because I know I'm not bright enough to have suggested this. So whichever one of you did this is a great idea.
Oh, thank I have you. No idea. I'm just here for the alligators.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. Speaking of which, I just want to bring this up again. I keep showing people my new Loki Gator. And they are like super impressed by it.
And where did you get your Loki Gator?
Kelly mailed it to me and then had me call her on FaceTime so she could see my response when I opened it.
To be fair, this all started because I texted Lisa and said, Lisa, would you please give me your address so that I can send you ludicrous things via mail? And Lisa, being a smart person, went, this sounds like a plan I need in on.
Oh, my God, yes. Who doesn't want to receive ludicrous things in the mail?
So exactly. I just want to tell you, Lisa, that Kelly did this to me when we barely knew each other.
Uh-huh.
After like, what, two episodes of Uncanny Valley?
I think so.
And it was just one of the smartest things I ever did was to give her my address.
Yes. So.
And what did you get?
I've gotten several things, and I have a stack on my shelf about that.
So the moral of the story is, if Kelly Gamont ever asks for your address, just no questions. Just
give
asked.
It to her.
Give no. it to it's her. That's move. Like the it's, best.
She do. Won't send terrorists. She'll send Funko Pop figures and all kinds of things. So it's really it's really marvelous.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So I have a friend. Hi, Isaiah. Who printed, somebody sent me, because, you know, hashtag branding, right? As they say, I said, you know, like, we need all the Swamp Kitten content we can get our hands on. And somebody said, hey, Kelly, check this out. And it was a link to a Thingiverse item, which was this Loki Gator complete with the gold headdress. And
so delightful.
So on Twitter, and I immediately went, who do I know? With a 3D printer and a deep abiding love for alligators and also Kelly. And somebody said, and my friend Isaiah said, I have some green that would be perfect for this. And I said, is there any chance you could make two? And he said, and because I said, like, it's for me and Lisa, because Lisa, like, there's a whole thing where, like, she has a Zoom membership just to get, like, regular doses of I need to explain to you. Like, I was pleading my case, basically. Mm-hmm. And he was like, I have enough for two. So sent them to me. And then I immediately turned around and took the box and took mine out and went, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen. And then I took the other one and taped it back up in the box and sent it off to Lisa.
She does this kind of thing all the time, folks. She does this kind of thing all the time.
It's just a delight. Also, I really feel the need to shout out to our Swamp Kitten Army. Actually, yes. Our Swamp Kitten Kindle, our Kindle of Swamp Kittens, our beloved Kindle of Swamp Kittens. You know, I say that and I sound like the Grandmaster.
Is that the technical term, Kindle?
Kindle, yes. Kindle is the collective noun for a boatload of, for like just plural kittens.
Wow.
Collective so, kittens, yes.
Yes. Our Kindle of Swamp Kittens, because they routinely drop things in my Twitter mentions where it's Loki Gators and or just general like crocodilian related mayhem and memes, and I adore all of it. Thank you so much, our faithful Swamp Kittens. You're the only reason I stay on that hell site. So
a wonderful description of it. Yes.
Yes. Also, please feel free to hit us up on said hell site. We love hearing from you. We love hearing your crackpot theories. We would love to hear your takes on what Iron Man and Thor are like when you watch them in these, the exciting end of phase 4 times in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Kelly is the one who can rattle off our Twitter address with no problem whatsoever. So I'm going to bump it to her.
It is at I Want My MCU TV. And you can find all three of us piping up there occasionally. and feel free to reply. We, one of us eventually, I promise, will get back to you. And if you would like to talk to us in a more direct and immediate fashion, you can become a member of The Incomparable, which will get you access to the member Slack, where you can get a hold of all of us. And if you so desire, you can follow the trend that is sweeping the Slack of people who have changed their display name in Slack to Swamp Kitten. And then their first name. And I need you to understand how happy I am, because there was a moment when two of our swamp kittens waved at each other within Slack because they both were swamp kitten names. And I just freaked out. And you need to know, like,
she lost it.
Heartwarming it is.
There were many texts.
Yes. Go to the member Slack now and witness this moment.
Several in all caps. I'm not going to lie. It was, it's certainly, I absolutely love it.
What we lack in coherence, we make up for in enthusiasm. So
indeed.
This, you know, Lisa, that is a description of our podcast in a nutshell, right there. Just
all enthusiasm, zero technique.
Yes, exactly.
What we lack in coherence, we make up for in enthusiasm.
Exactly.
Yes.
And you know, sometimes there's a place for that. But all good things must come to an end, as I think neither Q nor Picard said in one of my favorite episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation. And so too must this podcast. I want to thank Don Melton.
Yo.
And I want to thank Kelly Gamont.
Give me a scotch. I'm starving.
And having more fun than the rest of you on this podcast, I'm Lisa Schmeiser. Have a great day, everybody.